Chapter 12. When we arose at sunrise, to see the famous entry to Constantinople, we found, in the place of the city and the sun, a bright white fog, which hid both from sight, and which only disappeared as the vessel advanced towards the Golden Horn. There the fog cleared off as it were by flakes, and as you see gauze curtains lifted away, one by one, before a great fairy scene at the theater. This will give idea enough of the fog. The difficulty is to describe the scene afterwards, which was in truth the great fairy scene, than which it is impossible to conceive anything more brilliant and magnificent. I can't go to any more romantic place than Drury Lane, to draw my similes from Drury Lane, such as we used to see it in our youth, when to our sight the grand last pictures of the melodrama or pantomime were as magnificent as any objects of nature we have seen with maturer eyes. Well, the view of Constantinople is as fine as any of Stanfield's best theatrical pictures, seen at the best period of youth, when fancy had all the bloom on her, when all the heroines who danced before the scene appeared as ravishing beauties, when there shone an unearthly splendor about Baker and Didier, and the sound of the bugles and fiddles, and the cheerful clang of the cymbals, as the scene unrolled, and the gorgeous procession meandered triumphantly through it caused a thrill of pleasure, and awakened an innocent fullness of sensual enjoyment, that is only given to boys. The above sentence contains the following propositions. The enjoyments of boyish fancy are the most intense and delicious in the world. Stanfield's panorama used to be the realization of the most intense youthful fancy. I puzzle my brains and find no better likeness for the place. The view of Constantinople resembles the ne plus ultra of a Stanfield diorama, with a glorious accompaniment of music, spangled towers, warriors, and winding processions, feasting the eyes and the soul with light, splendor, and harmony. If you were never in this way during your youth ravished at the playhouse, of course the whole comparison is useless. And you have no idea, from this description, of the effect which Constantinople produces on the mind. But if you were never affected by a theater, no words can work upon your fancy, and typographical attempts to move it are of no use. For, suppose we combine musk, minaret, gold, cypress, water, blue, cakes, 74, galata, tapana, ramazan, bagalum, and so forth, together, in ever so many ways, your imagination will never be able to depict a city out of them. Or, suppose I say the Mosque of St. Sophia is 473 feet in height, measuring from the middle nail of the gilt crescent surmounting the dome to the ring in the center stone. The circle of the dome is 123 feet in diameter, the windows 97 in number, and all this may be true, for anything I know to the contrary. Yet who is to get an idea of St. Sophia from dates, proper names, and calculations with a measuring line? It can't be done, by giving the age and measurement of all the buildings along the river, the names of all the boatmen who ply on it. Has your fancy, which pooh-poohs a simile, faith enough to build a city with a foot rule? Enough said about descriptions and similes, though whenever I am uncertain of one I am naturally most anxious to fight for it. It is a scene not perhaps sublime, but charming, magnificent, and cheerful beyond any I have ever seen. The most superb combination of city and gardens, domes and shipping, hills and water, with the healthiest breeze blowing over it, and above it the brightest and most cheerful sky. It is proper, they say, to be disappointed on entering the town, or any of the various quarters of it, because the houses are not so magnificent on inspection, and seen singly as they are when beheld en masse from the waters. But why form expectations so lofty? If you see a group of peasants picturesquely disposed at a fair, you don't suppose that they are all faultless beauties, or that the men's coats have no rags, and the women's gowns are made of silk and velvet. The wild ugliness of the interior of Constantinople or Pera has a charm of its own, greatly more amusing than rows of red bricks or drab stones, however symmetrical. With brick or stone they could never form those fantastic ornaments, railings, balconies, roofs, galleries, which jut in and out of the rugged houses of the city. As we went from Galata to Pira up a steep hill, which newcomers ascend with some difficulty, but which a porter, with a couple of hundredweight on his back, paces up without turning a hair, I thought the wooden houses, far from being disagreeable objects, sights quite as surprising and striking as the grand one we had just left. I do not know how the custom house of His Highness is made to be a profitable speculation. As I left the ship, a man pulled after my boat and asked for backsheesh, which was given him to the amount of about 2 pence. He was a custom house officer, but I doubt whether this sum which he levied ever went to the revenue. I can fancy the scene about the quay somewhat, to resemble the River of London in olden times, before coal smoke had darkened the whole city with soot, and when, according to the old writers, there really was bright weather. The fleets of cakes bustling along the shore, or scudding over the blue water, are beautiful to look at. In Oller's print, London River is so studded over with wherry boats, which bridges and steamers have since destroyed. Here the cake is still in full perfection. There are 30,000 boats of the kind plying between the cities. Every boat is neat and trimly carved and painted, and I scarcely saw a man pulling in one of them that was not a fine specimen of his race, brawny and brown, with an open chest and a handsome face. They wear a thin shirt of exceedingly light cotton, which leaves their fine brown limbs full play, and with a purple sea for a background, every one of these dashing boats forms a brilliant and glittering picture. Passengers squat in the inside of the boat, so that as it passes you see little more than the heads of the true believers, with their red fez and blue tassel, and that placid gravity of expression which the sucking of a tobacco pipe is sure to give to a man. The Bosphorus is enlivened by a multiplicity of other kinds of craft. There are the dirty men of war's boats of the Russians, with unwashed mangy crews, the great ferry boats carrying hundreds of passengers to the villages, the melon boats piled up with enormous golden fruit, His Excellency the Pasha's boat, with 12 men bending to their oars, and His Highness's own cake, with a head like a serpent, and 28 tugging oarsmen, that goes shooting by amidst the thundering of the cannon. Ships and steamers, with black sides and flaunting colors, are moored everywhere, showing their flags, Russian and English, Austrian, American, and Greek. And along the quays country ships from the Black Sea or the islands, with high carved poops and bows, such as you see in the pictures of the shipping of the 17th century. The vast groves and towers, domes, and quays, tall minarets and spired spreading mosques of the three cities, rise all around in endless magnificence and variety, and render this water street a scene of such delightful liveliness and beauty, that one never tires of looking at it. I lost a great number of the sights in and round Constantinople through the beauty of this admirable scene. But what are sights after all? And isn't that the best sight which makes you most happy? We were lodged at Pira at Miss Ceres' hotel, the host of which has been made famous ere this time by the excellent book Othon, a work for which all the passengers on board our ship had been battling, and which had charmed all from our great statesman, our polished lawyer, our young Exonian, who sighed over certain passages that he feared were wicked, down to the writer of this, who, after perusing it with delight, laid it down with wonder, exclaiming, "Ah, diabolus, ah, a book which has since, greatest miracle of all, excited a feeling of warmth and admiration in the bosom of the godlike, impartial, stony Athenium. Miss Siri, the faithful and chivalrous Tartar, is transformed into the most quiet and gentlemanlike of landlords, a great deal more gentlemanlike in manner and appearance than most of us who sat at his table and smoked cool pipes on his housetop, as we looked over the hill and the Russian palace to the water and the Seraglio gardens shining in the blue. We confronted Miss Siri, Ethan in hand, and found, on examining him, that it was a diabolus ad amicus, but the name is a secret. I will never breathe it, though I am dying to tell it. The last good description of a Turkish bath, I think, was Lady Mary Wortley Montagu's, which voluptuous picture must have been painted at least 130 years ago, so that another sketch may be attempted by a humbler artist in a different manner. The Turkish bath is certainly a novel sensation to an Englishman, and may be set down as a most queer and surprising event of his life. I made the valet de place a dragoman. It is rather a fine thing to have a dragoman in one's service. Conduct me forthwith to the best appointed hummums in the neighborhood. And we walked to a house atop on a, and into a spacious hall lighted from above, which is the cooling room of the bath. The spacious hall has a large fountain in the midst, a painted gallery running round it, and many ropes stretched from one gallery to another, ornamented with profuse draperies of towels and blue cloths, for the use of the frequenters of the place. All round the room and the galleries were matted enclosures, fitted with numerous neat beds and cushions for reposing on, where lay a dozen of true believers smoking, or sleeping, or in the happy half-dozing state. I was led up to one of these beds, to rather a retired corner, in consideration of my modesty, and to the next bed presently came a dancing dervish, who forthwith began to prepare for the bath. When the dancing dervish had taken off his yellow sugar loaf cap, his gown, shawl, and tie, he was arrayed in two large blue cloths, a white one being thrown over his shoulders, and another in the shape of a turban plaited neatly round his head. The garments of which he divested himself were folded up in another linen, and neatly put by. I beg leave to state I was treated in precisely the same manner as the dancing dervish. The reverend gentleman then put on a pair of wooden pattens, which elevated him about 6 inches from the ground, and walked down the stairs, and paddled across the moist marble floor of the hall, and in at a little door, by the which also Titmarsh entered. But I had none of the professional agility of the dancing dervish. I staggered about very ludicrously upon the high wooden pattens, and should have been down on my nose several times, had not the dragoman and the master of the bath supported me down the stairs and across the hall. Dressed in three large cotton napkins, with a white turban round my head, I thought of Pall Mall with a sort of despair. I passed the little door, it was closed behind me, I was in the dark, I couldn't speak the language in a white turban. Mon Dieu! What was going to happen? The dark room was the tepidarium, a moist oozing arched den, with a light faintly streaming from an orifice in the domed ceiling. Yells of frantic laughter and song came booming and clanging through the echoing arches, the doors clapped to with loud reverberations. It was the laughter of the followers of Mahound, rollicking and taking their pleasure in the public bath. I could not go into that place. I swore I would not. They promised me a private room, and the dragoman left me. My agony at parting from that Christian cannot be described. When you get into the sudarium, or hot room, your first sensations only occur about half a minute after entrance, when you feel that you are choking. I found myself in that state, seated on a marble slab. The bathman was gone. He had taken away the cotton turban and shoulder shawl. I saw I was in a narrow room of marble, with a vaulted roof, and a fountain of warm and cold water. The atmosphere was in a steam, the choking sensation went off, and I felt a sort of pleasure presently in a soft boiling simmer, which, no doubt, potatoes feel when they are steaming. You are left in this state for about 10 minutes. It is warm certainly, but odd and pleasant, and disposes the mind to reverie. But let any delicate mind in Baker Street fancy my horror when, on looking up out of this reverie, I saw a great brown wretch extended before me, only half-dressed, standing on pattens, and exaggerated by them, and the steam until he looked like an ogre, grinning in the most horrible way, and waving his arm, on which was a horsehair glove. He spoke, in his unknown nasal jargon, words which echoed through the arched room. His eyes seemed astonishingly large and bright, his ears stuck out, and his head was all shaved, except a bristling top knot, which gave it a demoniac fierceness. This description, I feel, is growing too frightful. Ladies who read it will be going into hysterics, or saying, well, upon my word, this is the most singular, the most extraordinary kind of language. Jane, my love, you will not read that odious book, and so I will be brief. This grinning man belabors the patient violently with the horse brush. When he has completed the horsehair part, and you lie expiring under a squirting fountain of warm water, and fancying all is done, he reappears with a large brass basin, containing a quantity of lather, in the midst of which is something like old Miss McWhirter's flaxen wig, that she is so proud of, and that we have all laughed at. Just as you are going to remonstrate, the thing like the wig is dashed into your face and eyes, covered over with soap, and for 5 minutes you are drowned in lather. You can see, the suds are frothing over your eyeballs. You can hear, the soap is whizzing into your ears. Can gasp for breath, Miss McWhirter's wig is down your throat with half a pailful of suds in an instant you are all soap. Wicked children in former days have jeered you, exclaiming, how are you off for soap? You little knew what saponacity was till you entered a Turkish bath. When the whole operation is concluded, you are led with what heartfelt joy I need not say softly back to the cooling room, having been robed in shawls and turbans as before. You are laid gently on the reposing bed. Somebody brings a nargle, which tastes as tobacco must taste in Mahomet's paradise. A cool, sweet, dreamy languor takes possession of the purified frame, and half an hour of such delicious laziness is spent over the pipe as is unknown in Europe, where vulgar prejudice has most shamefully maligned indolence, calls it foul names, such as the father of all evil, and the like. In fact, does not know how to educate idleness as those honest Turks do, and the fruit which, when properly cultivated, it bears. The after-bath state is the most delightful condition of laziness I ever knew, and I tried it, wherever we went afterwards on our little tour. At Smyrna the whole business was much inferior to the method employed in the capital. At Cairo, after the soap, you are plunged into a sort of stone coffin, full of water which is all but boiling. This has its charms, but I could not relish the Egyptian shampooing. A hideous old blind man, but very dexterous in his art, tried to break my back and dislocate my shoulders, but I could not see the pleasure of the practice. And another fellow began tickling the soles of my feet, but I rewarded him with a kick that sent him off the bench. The pure idleness is the best, and I shall never enjoy such in Europe again. Victor Hugo, in his famous travels on the Rhine, visiting Cologne, gives a learned account of what he didn't see there. I have a remarkable catalogue of similar objects at Constantinople. I didn't see the dancing dervishes, it was Ramazan, nor the howling dervishes at Scutari, it was Ramazan, nor the interior of St. Sophia, nor the women's apartment of the Seraglio, nor the fashionable promenade at the Sweet Waters, always because it was Ramazan, during which period the dervishes dance and howl but rarely, their legs and lungs being unequal to much exertion during a fast of 15 hours. On account of the same holy season, the royal palaces and mosques are shut, and though the valley of the Sweet Waters is there, no one goes to walk, the people remaining asleep all day, and passing the night in feasting and carousing. The minarets are illuminated at this season. Even the humblest mosque at Jerusalem, or Jaffa, mounted a few circles of dingy lamps. Those of the capital were handsomely lighted with many festoons of lamps, which had a fine effect from the water. I need not mention other and constant illuminations of the city, which innumerable travelers have described. I mean the fires. There were 3 in Pira during our 8 days' stay there, but they did not last long enough to bring the Sultan out of bed to come and lend his aid. Mr. Hobhouse, quoted in the guidebook, says, if a fire lasts an hour, the Sultan is bound to attend it in person, and that people having petitions to present have often set houses on fire for the purpose of forcing out this royal trump. The Sultan can lead a very ollie life, if this rule be universal. Fancy His Highness, in the midst of his moon-faced beauties, handkerchief. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.